This week, gold finished near the break-even point while the Dow closed at an all-time record, the highest in about its 120-year history. Welcome back, everyone. Chris Waltzek, just great to be back with you. Just as anticipated in last week's show, the metal consolidation came to pass, and gold bounced back from lows and support, closing in a solid position for potentially more gains this year. Joining me with their take on the precious metals and all the sectors, two more big industry insiders, Dr. Stephen Lieb. Is it just me? Does this individual have the most interesting topicality? I don't know. Maybe I'm just a shut-in, spend too much time in front of the computer screen and the laptop. But Dr. Stephen Lieb, best-selling author, 7 bestsellers wasn't enough. He decided to, write another one. He's got a gold book ready for the printing presses and undoubtedly destined to be another bestseller. Says gold deserves its rightful status as the currency backing asset of choice, and even the U.S. dollar is eventually going to hold it. He's got some really unconventional thoughts about gold stockpiles. He says China could have almost any size. That 3,000 to 4,000 number just doesn't hold any water, according to his analysis. It could be 20,000 tons or more, maybe 3, 5, 10 size larger than the U.S., which currently has the official biggest gold stockpile at Fort Knox. Covers every interesting topic. You just need to listen in. It's a waste of breath to try to cover it all. Then good friend of the show, Kevin Kerr, returns after, about a 2-year hiatus. He rejoins the show back in the U.S. now, and he outlines why all the stars are in alignment for a multi-year gold bull market. He thinks even silver could outperform the bull's expectation in the next leg higher this year. He's holding his family's wealth in gold and silver assets while advocating diversification over speculation, all solid ideas. The Market Weather Report returns next week. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. My featured guest today, Dr. Stephen Lieb, 25 years of investment experience. I bet it's more than that by now. Just finished up his gold magnum opus. Welcome back, Dr. Lieb.
Thank you so much, Chris. I really appreciate being here, and I wish I'd only been in the business 25 years, but it's longer than that. I won't say how much.
We were talking before the show, and I wanted to get all this interesting information in about your latest tome that has been accepted by the publisher.
Not quite that yet, but I have a good feeling it will be. I do have one of the top agents in the country. It's one thing I share with Michael Lewis is that we have the same agent. We don't have the same writing skills, unfortunately, but we do have the same agent. He does like the book very much, and we're confident that we'll sell it. And unlike other books that I have written in the past, this one is largely written. We have to add things here and there. And when you're talking about something as current as gold, virtually every week another item comes up that you have to incorporate. I think we actually will get this book out in fairly short order. And I'm hoping that it will help a lot of people and encourage them to, broaden their asset base a bit. Gold is a much neglected asset in this country. And I think it's going to be the cornerstone of our monetary system. I mean, it just doesn't seem to be headed any other way than toward something other than the dollar, something other than reserve currencies. I hate to use the phrase fiat currency, but it's there. It's paper money. I never thought I would be talking like this. I have to say that it is as an aside. If you known me 10 or 15 years ago, I mean, this is such a foreign speech for me to be talking about fiat currencies and gold and precious metals as being a cornerstone for our monetary system and for our economy. But the world has changed just in ways that were hard to imagine. But here we are, circa 2016, and we're faced with a situation unlike any that we've ever seen. It's going to imply a lot more changes to come, and I think gold will be at the center of many of those changes.
Firstly, hat tip, we'd certainly love to see your book become also a smash hit movie.
Never match Michael Lewis. I've told my agent, no. That's one thing that we share in common, and the only thing we share in common. Michael Lewis and I have the same agent, but that's it. Beyond that, you know, he's a magnificent writer, a magnificent reporter. I'm much more an academic. You know, I just don't have his, magical writing touch. But I think what I say, you know, does turn out to be pretty good. And I have kept people, I think by and large in pretty good shape over the past times that I've been in the business. You know, I hope to continue to do so in the future. My reads are not necessarily fun reads. So, that, you know, I will say that in all fairness. But yes, I do share the same agent as Michael Lewis. I'm proud to admit, yes.
I don't know how fun The Big Short was to read. I guess it depends on your perspective. If you were short the housing market and didn't watch your family lose like over 10 million U.S. families to home foreclosures, it's really more of a Stephen King like horror story.
It is, and it's and Michael Lewis. There's a lot to learn from Michael Lewis. I mean, you can't take. I think it's hard to take specific investment advice from him. The book before. I can't remember whether it was before or came right after The Big Short. I think it came actually after The Big Short, which was Flash Boys, talking about making money in nano trading. I mean, you know, that says something right there about America. I mean, here you have trading people competing with each other in terms of literally nanoseconds. Who gets the order on the to the machines first, you know, wins the prize. That's not a recipe for productivity. And, of course, I mean, The Big Short, you know, really speaks for itself. I mean, it was a movie, and I thought a very, very good movie, a very instructive movie. On display in that movie is the decadence involved in capitalism. You know, the willingness of these rating agencies to rate these combination of mortgage bonds as AAA. I mean, I thought he just did a brilliant job in you know, capitalism, you know, unfettered. How easy it is just to create money out of nothing, and how people, you know, can lose. The entire system can lose. And it was certainly on the brink of losing. And, you know, I think displayed a system, you know, nearly bankrupt. And I fear that we're going to go through another type of crisis similar to that. Maybe after we get done with that crisis, we'll have more of a foundation. We will sort of have hit bottom and maybe have more of a foundation to go forward. You know, the tragedy of what happened in 2008, 2009, it just doesn't seem we've learned anything about it from it. It seems like we're going to make the same kinds of mistakes. Recently, I would say within the past 2 weeks, for the first time in my life, I mean, I worry about things, children, you know, whatever, family, et cetera. And sometimes it keeps you up at night, and you'll wake up at night and you'll be worried about, you know, something or other that's related to you and your family. But I have never, ever, until I would say 2 weeks ago, woken up worried desperately about the economy, the world's economy. I look at these negative interest rates, which are affecting, I think, majority of sovereign bonds now are trading at negative interest rates. This is just, things are changing, and they're changing, you know, in a way that's certainly pointing toward a major, a sort of seismic shift in how we govern our economies. And, you know, much of the change is involved in a lot shifting from west to east. And I think we're sort of starting to recognize that, but I think China is going to have a huge, massive role in the world's economy. And I think there's just very little doubt about that. And it doesn't mean that we have to be left in its shadows, but it means that we have to, you know, really change our ways and, you know, sort of start repairing water pipes, start putting up new grid, start, you know, investing in infrastructures that can really put America back to work again and, you know, start increasing our productivity. We're not doing any of the above. And, you know, the costs are just enormous. The costs are negative productivity, all this money and no place to invest because no one can agree and everybody has so much debt as a result of it. I mean, it just goes on and on. So, yeah, I think we're on the cusp of a very, very significant change.
You know, you brought up some great topics there, and one of them, negative interest rates. There is some talk that eventually, even the U.S., I mean, look, we've got Japan with Shinzo Abe's regime now with much more power and control, and they obviously are pro-negative rates and QE, and of course the EU is just trying to hold things together. I had this interesting conversation with an executive a couple of days ago, and he directed me to this term called the Metropolitan Club. But apparently there's a fifth floor on the Metropolitan Club outside of New York, where the world's wealthiest have a tendency to congregate. And there is some talk that a new Jekyll Island-like discussion has either taken place or is in negotiation. If negative rates ever come to the United States, a gold backing of some sort to our currency. Have you heard anything of this?
Vaguely have, yes. I mean, and I think the question is, how much gold do we have? And are we able to do that? I'm not sure we are, to be very, very honest. You know, there's a question as to whether we even have the 8,000 tons of gold in this country to do any sort of backing. We may, and we may not. I think we're as opaque as the Chinese when it comes to how much gold we have. And that would be a very, very important question. But yes, if the gold were there, I mean, A, I have heard stories like that. B, the credibility of such a story would rest upon how much gold. Can we actually do that? I'm not sure. I mean, you know, how about backing currencies and rare earths? Of course, we would never do that, but we don't have them. I mean, we have them, but they're totally undeveloped in this country, and it would take Manhattan-like projects to do it. I mean, I don't want to get too much adrift, but what I'm saying, much depends upon whether we have the gold or silver or, you know, anything like that. We certainly don't import gold, from what I know. Whatever gold we have would be, I think, that original 8,000 tons. I don't think we've added to it. On the other hand, I think the Chinese have much, much more gold than you know, we realize. Two very disparate things, but I think they illustrate more or less the same. It has been the growth. It's not my chart. It comes from Nature magazine, so it's, you know, very well grounded. Between 2000 and now 2015, actually last year, China has grown its supercomputer industry. This is a very high-tech industry. It has grown it from one supercomputer to 168. In the same period of time, our supercomputer industry has fallen from 250 to 165. In other words, China now has more supercomputers than the United States. Not only that, for the last 7 or 8 years, China's computers, supercomputers, have been faster than ours, and they are much faster than ours right now. What this has allowed China to do is basically, and I don't think a lot of people know this, China right now is the largest electronic money processor in the world. They process more money than Visa and MasterCard. They probably process about as much as Visa now, but by the end of the year, they will process more. They issue more credit cards than Visa and MasterCard combined. The company that does this rose right along with the supercomputers. It's called China Union Pay, or CUP, C-U-P. It's just a remarkable feat that this company started from nothing, and now basically is on the verge of dominating electronic money processing. You know, another fact is that you hear a lot about bitcoins and virtual currencies. Well, guess who dominates that industry? China. And they do that by virtue of, I think, at least part and parcel of it, is their leading position of supercomputers. You need supercomputers to help with the software that defines the virtual currencies. You need supercomputers to help with the massive amount of processing that goes on with these credit cards and debit cards. And they're there, and they're getting bigger and bigger in this. And sort of my argument, I mean, one of my arguments would be any country that can go from 1 to the number one, literally, from nowhere, number one to hegemony, in a brief period of time, can in that same relatively brief period of time accumulate massive amounts of gold. All we know now about China's gold holdings is that they're almost surely much higher than China admits. Regular news agencies or news agencies that are trustworthy, you know, come up with estimates that are higher than that. And Bloomberg and other agencies that don't have kind of a bent that, you know, would let them say, well, China's, you know, doing things that, you know, you wouldn't expect them to do. When you step back, the only thing you know about China, Chris, and potential gold is that they hold about $1.2 trillion in treasury securities, bills, bonds, and notes. Their total reserves, their reserves have gone down, but still, when you, if you count their sovereign wealth fund, you end up with about $4 trillion in total foreign reserves. That's what they say they have. They don't tell you how they're divided. They got a free pass on that. Every other country has to say how their reserves are allocated. China does not. So there you have $2.8 trillion in reserves in which we don't know how they're allocated. They also have another $3 trillion in bank deposits by just government agencies have left the equivalent of $3 trillion in Chinese banks, probably to backstop debt. But, you know, who knows what they're going to, you know, how they've invested that money. They also have an additional $3 trillion, the Chinese banks, deposited with the PBOC. This is what we do know. And that gives them nearly $9 trillion. That's enough money to buy all the gold in the world. Now, I don't think they've bought all the gold in the world. Obviously not. But it gives them the wherewithal to have bought massive amounts of gold. Whether they have or not, I don't know. And how much they have, I don't know. But I know that they certainly could own massive amounts of gold at this point. We have to be very conscious of that. Now, if the Metropolitan Club is saying that we own, instead of 8,000 tons of gold, which I don't think would do a whole lot, well, 8,000 tons of gold in today's world is worth about $380 billion. It's a small percentage of our GDP. If they own the 8,000, yeah, maybe we could do a little bit with that. But if China has, let's say, 20,000 tons of gold, 25, who knows? I mean, they're just in a much, much better position. And, you know, given their position in things like virtual currencies, in things like credit processing, debit processing, it's something that, you know, I don't think that we grasp. And I'm not sure that the people at the Metropolitan Club do, but they may know something I don't know. But I do think that China could be in an incredibly good position at this point. You know, their ambitions are to, you know, build out the entire East, literally with this one belt, one road, and, you know, to do a lot of that with gold. I mean, the acquiring of gold is not just confined to China. It's also confined, it's also part of Russia's policy, and it's also, you know, endemic in the eastern part of the world. They like gold. The West doesn't particularly like gold. You know, I'm just offering, you know, a counter to those that, you know, think that the U.S. can do that. But yes, I have heard those rumors that we're thinking of doing something with gold. I'm just not sure that we're in a position to do something with gold. That would be my question. It wouldn't be that I know. I mean, I think too much of this is opaque. I do know China's in probably a better position than us to have accumulated massive, massive amounts of gold over the past, I don't know, 5 or 10 years.
It's such an interesting perspective, and I'd like to give our listeners some context here. I mean, we're talking about the potential for 20,000 tons, 25,000. This is difficult, even with numbers behind it or dollar signs behind it, to grasp. But here's some perspective. You know, we have roughly 10,000 tons in the United States, and it's universally known as the world's largest stockpile. If, again, we believe it's there, it's unencumbered, it hasn't been leased out. And we've heard some interesting commentary from, of course, your myself and Dr. Ron Paul. But if you're right, I mean, this is a strategic advantage that would be incomparable if it's 20, 30,000 tons. I mean, it could be virtually any number. And another interesting aspect to this tale, we regularly have folks from Hong Kong, Peru, Saxena, and others, and they're talking about huge inflows, almost immeasurable amounts of tonnage of gold flowing from Hong Kong into the mainland.
Yes, have been, and exports from Hong Kong to China, yes, are part of it. You know, remarkably, there it's not that much of a part of it. They get gold from all sorts of sources. I mean, the Swiss export gold to them. Britain exports gold to them. It's basically comes from many, many different places. I mean, and the estimates from people that are very, very smart. I mean, for instance, I think just this year, there's a Singapore website that talks about how much gold China has gathered. And this is, doesn't count the PBOC. This doesn't count monetary gold. This just counts gold for investment. And they figure about, well, they figured last year about 2,500 tons, I think. And Nomura, the brokerage firm, who's credible, they figured about over 4,000 tons. So, I mean, you know, it just varies all over the place. China is very good at keeping secrets. And, you know, part and parcel of this, again, I'm just thinking about this, could be their expertise in these supercomputers, which allow them sort of an advantage in, you know, hiding flows. If they're leasing, if they have dollar deposits and they use that to, you know, basically secure options on gold in the future, I mean, anything is possible. It's sort of beyond my pay grade to think of all the possibilities. But I do come up, Chris, very straightforwardly with nearly $9 trillion that China has, that would be enough to basically buy all the gold in the world at what the current price of about 1320. They don't own all the gold in the world. I'm quite sure of that, but they could own a much larger percentage of that gold than anyone thinks is possible.
As you say, all kinds of possibilities. And one of them with your supercomputer idea, also mentioning bitcoins, well, of course, that involves encryption.
That's exactly right. Yes, yes. Sorry. I mean, yes, you've got it. Yes.
I was thinking of another strategic advantage. We saw what, you know, Alan Turing did for the Allies against the Axis, and that was almost 100, I don't want to say 100 years ago, but 80 years ago.
Well, he was rewarded for doing it.
Yeah, what a terrible reward. That's a shame, but at least they recognize that, whereas so many unsung heroes have been lost. And this really gives China such a strategic advantage. And again, we can learn from this. We don't have to fear it.
Yes, I think that you're right. One thing that we have to be happy about is that China does not have to be an enemy of ours. I mean, China is not an acquisitive power. They're not seeking to acquire anything more than what they need to be secure in their own country. You know, they consider themselves, or they're best viewed, I think, as sort of a nation civilization, if you will. China goes back three or four or five, I don't know how many millennia. They've spoken the same language. They're the same familiar structure. I mean, there's so much about this civilization which has stayed in place for so long. Happy to do that. And what they're trying to do is build the structure and the infrastructure, I believe, for a prosperous 21st century for them. That does not have to mean a bad 21st century for America, you know, unless we make it so. So, I mean, I think China's success and ascension in today's world does not have to be a bad thing for us, but it does mean that we have to wake up and we have to, you know, get with it, and we have to start investing in things we need to invest in. I mean, Chris, productivity, I mean, the last three quarters we've had negative productivity in this country. That, you know, no country can last for long with those kinds of statistics. It's that simple.
That is something that technology has a tendency to boost productivity.
Yes, yes, yes.
But, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't maybe redirect the discussion back to the precious metals and your upcoming tome. We don't want you to give too much away, nothing proprietary. You've already woven some of the interesting topicality into this discussion today. We don't have to look too far out, I suppose, or speculate too much in either direction, but maybe the type of economic situation that might lead to better years ahead for the precious metals.
Well, I think that what will lead to better years ahead for, you know, a lot of things will be, you know, building out infrastructure and trying to, you know, allocate commodities to infrastructure building and investment. I mean, the East right now is wholly undeveloped. I mean, basically, you have a world in which about 17% of the population controls, I don't know, 75% of the wealth. That other 80% or so of the world controls very little of the wealth. You're going to see a shift there. You're going to see higher commodity prices. You may see scarcity. You're going to have intense focus on investing in the right kinds of things. I mean, just as one example that I've used in many, many cases, this country is still rich in a lot of resources, yet every year you look at the USGS, United States Geophysical Survey, and you find that we are importing more and more commodities. And, you know, one group of commodities which has been talked to death, but it should be talked to death. I mean, it should be more than talked to death. I mean, we should take action on it, are rare earths. I mean, rare earths are essential to our military, essential to almost much of what we do in modern life requires magnetism, and rare earths are the shortest way to permanent magnets, and they're the best way. And we have massive deposits of rare earths. We don't have any universities in this country which really offer programs in rare earth engineering. I mean, it's very difficult to take a deposit of rare earths and turn what you get out of that deposit into a permanent magnet. That's another major advantage China has, incidentally. I think they are the only country on the face of the earth. They have massive rare earth deposits. They're the only country that can actually take a rare earth deposit and turn it into a product, a permanent magnet, which can sit in a computer, which can sit in a car, which has all sorts of applications. We can't do that, but it's not for lack of resources. It's for lack of willingness to spend the money or invest the money, you know, like we did with the interstate highway system, like we did with the Manhattan Project. I think this would be much more than a Manhattan Project, and it would employ so many people in productive tasks and would give this country, you know, much, much greater independence. I mean, right now, I mean, I hate to say this, we're very dependent on China for these very, very special minerals and commodities. You know, that's one direction that we must head in. We must develop these new industries, and we must be, you know, prepared to, you know, invest or, you know, use our best brains to in cyber warfare, cybersecurity, you know, things like that, which have just, you know, we've just let drop. In the chaos of the political system, we sort of have lost track as to what has made America great, a sort of willingness to come together, build an interstate highway system, build Apollo, you know, going to the moon, the Manhattan Project, which, you know, basically was essential in the Second World War. We've been leaders in many, many areas, but we have sort of lost that sense of drive, and we've got to somehow reacquire that, I mean, in order to exist in this new century.
Don't you think that these programs you discuss, which I agree with you, I mean, they were my inspiration early on, you know, the Apollo mission, then, of course, followed by the space shuttle, and let's not forget the Hubble Deep Space Telescope.
Absolutely.
Much of that, I'm sure, was a partnership with the EU and other nations. And unfortunately, I think a big part here comes when the populace is experiencing economic distress. For instance, you know, look at CERN. To be involved with this, this Higgs boson discovery and all of that. I mean, how exciting. And we used to have that. We had the Fermi Lab not far from where you grew up. Yeah, your stomping ground.
Yes, exactly right. And a lot of good work came out of there. You know, what I do remember at the beginning of the Clinton administration, there was a proposal to build a massive collider like CERN. I mean, I don't know, I can't compare the sizes.
You are correct. And it was built, but they couldn't complete it because they ran out of funding.
Consortium of private and government money. You know, who knows what they would have discovered by now? You know, where we participate, we're not participating in CERN, and we're not participating to any extent in these experiments on nuclear fusion. You know, rare earths I just picked because it's something that I've studied, but, you know, you're absolutely right about these colliders. I mean, you know, so much good and knowledge can come out of that, and who knows how that knowledge is going to, you know, work, but you've got to be willing to try. I mean, so much has come out of the Apollo programs. I mean, talk about Bell Labs, Chris. Bell Labs now is just not even a shadow of itself. It's a mini shadow of itself. But I mean, everything from lasers to the internet, literally to the transistor, to, you know, all our modern technology came out of basically a semi-private organization, AT&T. They sponsored, you know, all this incredible research, which has laid the foundation for a lot of our basic IT, information technology. And there's no more Bell Labs. We've got to get back to what made us great. And I think hopefully we can. And maybe this shifting tide toward China right now will wake us up again and maybe force us to come together.
And this is so important because, you know, having reentered academia about 6 years ago after a long hiatus, there's been a real sea change. As you say, a huge influx of folks from China and from other nations with a great passion for physics, mathematics, and I'm talking advanced mathematics and economics.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, the articles, all the peer-reviewed journal articles in that area, and we can learn those skills, a mindset, a change in our mindset here in the U.S.
It absolutely will. I mean, you know, we don't have to play Pokemon. I mean, whatever it is. I mean, it's like I have a friend that's said that, you know, Trump should not build a wall between Mexico and the U.S. He should build a wall around the Ivy League because they're the most, you know, politically correct, you know, institutions in this country, and it's stultifying. I mean, I'm all for equality for everybody. I mean, I think we're all different and we're all whatever. I mean, I have a very Quaker-like philosophy about the world. What's happening when you can't, you know, talk and collaborate and without making sure every I is dotted and T is crossed and no one is insulted? I mean, this is not America. I mean, it doesn't, you know, inspire people. Something that we need to wake ourselves up and become a civilization. I mean, we need to work together if that's possible. I think that, you know, hopefully we can, but I don't see it happening now. And you talk about China again. My son, I'm happy that, you know, one of the people he's working with is a graduate. He has his PhD and he's doing like a postdoc and something. But one of the people he's working with is this Chinese woman who came from the University of Peking. And you know what the acceptance rate is at the University of Peking? I'll give you a hint. At Harvard, it's about 54 out of 1,000. Okay, that's at Harvard. You know what it is at the University of Peking? 1 in 1,000. 1 in 1,000. There are two universities that have that same acceptance rate. And to get in there, it's not a question of having the right father or the right legacy. It's a question of doing incredibly well on a particular exam. They're a meritocracy. We used to be a meritocracy. We're not anymore. Because of that, I think we're losing ground. The people running China, the premier of China, Li, who, you know, not she, but Li, she also is an incredibly accomplished guy. But Li, in particular, the fellow who I think is still in charge of the economy in China, he's a graduate of the University of Peking, and he won the award in China for the best PhD dissertation. So this is who they select to, you know, be the man in charge of the economy at the in China, the best that they have, the most skilled economist, basically. Who do we select in this country? I mean, they're, you know, some people are very good, but some people are not, etc. I mean, China basically is a meritocracy. And it doesn't mean that people that can't afford or don't have those skills to, you know, you know, be the best in physics are just, you know, cast away. They're not. You know, they're given other things. They fulfill their lives in other ways, but we have no way right now of making sure that the best or the most equipped are the people that really enjoy it more. Whatever it takes to do well on a test, I'm not saying anything about intelligence or anything like that, but there's a certain motivation that it takes, a certain willingness to study, a study hard. We basically have lost that. It's something that we've got to get back again. I mean, the people that rose to, you know, prominence in this country, the Gordon Moores, the Bardeens, who, you know, superconductivity, I mean, you know, the names go on, but they're all names that I think, you know, came from, let's say, the pre-1960 era or the pre-1970 era. We've got to get back to that era where science is revered, and it's not revered because it allows people to, you know, communicate with their friends via Facebook, people that they don't know, I mean, you know, and establish these relations. I mean, we've got to get back to, you know, nuts and bolts and the things that have made this country great. I think we can. I think, unfortunately, 2008-09 could have been a big wake-up call for it, but it just didn't turn out that way. And I think the next crisis will probably be the one that does wake us up. I'm still hopeful about America. I mean, I love so much about this country I love. I'm just unwilling to give up on it. So that's one of the reasons I write this book, to try and wake people up. And it has to start with a willingness to sort of bridge the gap between, you know, what one side is saying and what the other side is saying. I mean, I've taken to saying, you know, when people say, you know, well, who are you a Democrat or Republican? I said, I'm an American. And I think it has to be more that attitude. I mean, you know, a more willingness to come together and work together as one, and less a sense of entitlement. Yes, I think that there's just, you know, I agree with what you're saying, in short. I do. I think it's well put.
And I think we've covered a lot of the bases today. I mean, certainly you are looking for better times ahead for the precious metals. So as we wrap up, if you don't mind, share any information you'd like to about maybe websites or services.
Right. I think liebinvestor.com would be the place where you would go, you know, if you wanted to, you know, see, you know, the stuff that we do. But I'm much more concerned that you sort of like take to heart the kinds of stuff that we're talking about here and realize that, you know, we do have to come together and stop the fighting.
It's so important, you know, and let's turn off the nonsense, you know, on the screen, pick up a book or do some serious reading. I mean, we've got to get away from, I think, that culture. And that's maybe a topic for another show.
It is, but you're right on that. You are so right.
Dr. Stephen Lieb, thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris. It's always a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the 8th largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Kevin Kerr, president of Kerr Trading International, is back with us. Welcome back, Kevin.
Good to be here, Chris. Thank you. And there's so much going on now with the EU. There's so much to talk about with Brexit and all the impact it's going to have on a lot of commodities, but especially the metals, precious metals.
We're watching that very closely here to see whether or not more of these dominoes start to fall in the region. And let's talk about the precious metals. Obviously, we've seen a flight to quality, a flight to safety. But at the same time, we see global money flows and capital pouring into U.S. equities. They tend to be a bit more inversely correlated.
So we have so much going on right now. Of course, the dramatic vote in the U.K. that I really believe was unexpected by most people, but not so unexpected either. In many respects. But so we have that going on. And of course, the election year, very uncertain here in the U.S., who will be in, Trump or Hillary, and what does that mean for the market? So we got uncertainty on that. And of course, all the violence and terrorist things are going on in the world. As you pointed out, key NATO and EU countries on the cusp here, Italy, very concerning. In Turkey, of course, which just gone down with the supposed coup that didn't actually end up happening. So just a lot of events that make markets uncertain. I don't think we've seen the flight to quality that we would expect with all this turmoil going on. And as you said, a lot of cash is flowing into U.S. equities, even at these high, lofty levels. And my little radar screen is telling me, we're getting to that red line point. I don't know what that is. I'm not going to sit here and say this isn't going to keep going up. I really don't know what that point is, but it's getting on my radar screen anyway, concerning. It's right in the yellow heading into red. My opinion. So we got a lot on the plate right now.
No, exactly. And of course, it has been a solid year, as our listeners know, and you're aware, for the yellow metal, up roughly 30%, silver almost, in the neighborhood of 50%. And the XAU was on track for a 200% gain from trough to peak. An interesting theme. Many of my top guests seem to think that this time it's a bit different. Do you think we've turned the corner on the metals for good, or will we be backing and filling for the next few years?
I think we've seen so much of that backing and selling and kind of this narrow range the last several years with a lot of anticipation that we would see a leg significantly back up. But I think we have a lot of elements in place that we haven't had up to this point, especially in election year here in the U.S. and with what's happening abroad. These elements are getting to a critical point and I think are driving a lot. Right now, it hasn't really grabbed hold, but as more uncertainty is piled on or more events happen, again, there's a lot in flux right now, but I see that we could see a significant rally from here in gold. We've based kind of here. We've been above 1,200. We've been, in this range for quite some time. And now I think you'll see some new buying coming in that will really push this metal higher. Silver, I think, has been staggeringly ahead of gold, and I love it. But point is, I think we're going to see more flight to quality as these events ramp up, as we see what's going to happen with Britain, what's going to happen with Turkey, what's going to happen, And as those events unfold, I think it's not an easy solution, and people are going to be looking for a safe haven, and they're going to take some of that money out of equities and move it into something a little more tangible and secure. And I think that we probably see that this year, within 2016.
That's right along in line with comments of so many of our guests. And we have a very accommodative Fed, at least as far as the precious metal sector is concerned. I mean, our pundits here tend to say, well, the Fed, the FOMC, the policymakers tend to be behind the curve. They let the rates lead them. This caught the markets a bit off guard. I mean, with the stock market hitting new highs, the unemployment level pretty solid still, you would think that they might put the brakes on, but they don't plan to do that according to the Fed funds futures for the next 12 months.
The Fed has been behind the eight ball for a long, long time now, and it started down this path for all of us of, you know, talking about rate hikes and actually doing it and seeing what the impact is from that. And we constantly have this conversation, and we're just not in a position to really move into a higher rate environment at this point. Again, as you pointed out, you know, unemployment levels remain high. A lot of the factors we look at, if we really honestly look at them, does not point to that we are anywhere near ready to raise rates significantly or to be on a path to do so. I don't know when that ends. We printed a lot of money. Well, I didn't, but the Fed did. We got to clean it up, and there's no simple quick fix. All those goodies have been used up. All the QE2s and all that stuff is over. So now we got to find a real solution, and that's a lot harder. At this point, I don't see what the solution is. I hope they have one, because I do not. My solution is to keep my assets in a secure asset, like gold, precious metals, silver, and diversify, and just be cautious, because anything could happen, especially in an election year. We just don't know what's coming.
No, it's an excellent insurance policy for every portfolio, and we like to call it the premium-free insurance plan. So on a forward basis, what curveballs do you see headed this way? I mean, obviously, you've talked about the elections. We prefer to steer clear of politics for the most part. Obviously, November will be a key focal point of pivot. Do you expect policymakers to continue sitting on their hands, at least until November?
I do. You know, we typically see that leading up to an election. Nobody wants to really make any decision. Nothing's really going to get done. Everything's going to kind of be on hold until the election. I mean, that's if I look through history, that's kind of what's gone on in the past, too. So, I mean, there's a lot of wild cards here, and I agree with you. I'm not going to get into politics, and when I'm trading, I keep my emotions out of it as much as possible. Of course, it's not always possible, and you do have to look at what is the public, what is the perception going to be? Perception is reality, after all. So, one of the things that concerns me, and again, I'm not going to say which I'm voting for or what my politics is, but, you know, there's concerns here about comments that have been made about the economy and the dollar on both sides, And some of them are extreme and obviously opposite of each other. And it concerns me because how does the market perceive that? What would happen if the dollar loses any more of its luster on the world market from some of these actions? And so we have to be forward-looking. I don't think we have to panic because nothing's done yet, but you know, the uncertainty that can create in the market leading up to the election could cause a lot of volatility and a lot of concern. Setting politics aside, but still looking at it, you got to look at the different scenarios and what they could be. But I don't think you act on them until November, just like Congress and the Senate isn't probably going to do much until after November, too. And everybody knows where they land and who's still in business and what's going on, what the truth is, what's actually going to happen.
Let's look forward and assume that the presidential election comes and passes without any major glitches or trouble whatsoever, which I might be making a big assumption here. What might be a positive for the precious metals? Could Fed officials lower rates, even consider more QE operations to increase stability?
Great question, Chris. I mean, here we go. We can start theorizing what might happen, what can actually take place. Obviously, we're going to get two different results with Hillary. Mrs. Clinton, it's going to be one eye, and it's, with Mr. Trump, it's going to be another. I'm just going to take a scenario, and again, politics aside, I'm not going to tell you who I'm voting for, but let's say, you know, Donald Trump has said we can default on our debt, basically, and I'm not going to quote him directly, but, you know, that causes a lot of uncertainty, you know? The dollar instantly losing credibility on the world market because we say, well, we're not going to pay this bill, you know? I mean, these kind of extreme comments, I understand it's politics, but they set the market askew a little bit. Now, Hillary said some of the opposite things, but also is volatile on what it might do to the dollar. And the Fed, we just don't know what they'll do. It's going to largely depend on who becomes Fed chairman, or if we keep the same one we have now, or what the policy is set by the new administration. So I don't know. I mean, if they were to back out on rates again or start a new QE program, decrediting the dollar even more, and just digging our hole deeper. I wish I knew, Chris. I wish I had that crystal ball. And you could say, November's coming. Here's what happens. But we, none of us know. And that uncertainty, to me, scares me more than the reality. Because people can imagine things and what might happen. And that makes people nervous. And they're going to be a flight to quality. So I know gold is still going to be gold, even if the dollar's devalued more or doesn't keep its luster as where it is. So, you know, the uncertainty drives people to safe havens. And one of those is gold, one silver.
You know, the XAU and the precious metal shares certainly seem to lead these markets in at least many of the bull rallies, and that doesn't seem to have changed this time around. Do you expect shares to continue in, the next 3 to 5 years, a good opportunity for bullion purchases?
I think they're excellent, you know, and they've been performing very well and steady with good return. And I think over the next 3 to 4 years, you do see those ratchet up as well. But also not overly volatile, not huge rallies and not big drops, just slow and steady with the occasional move to a better price level. So I think you stair step higher rather than just shoot up in these markets particularly. Now, certain mining stocks are going to outperform others, individual issues. And I think you really, when you're looking at those stocks, you really have to look at what their debt situation is and are they a candidate to be bought out or whatever. But, you know, all of that. It's going to be shaken out. There's certainly a lot of struggle in the energy and the mining sector. So, you know, you got to price that out, each stock individually. But as far as the, ETFs and the funds, you know, there's a lot of good ones out there, but the two you named are excellent.
I'm sure you'd agree that most of the shares have divested unproductive resources, reduced expenses, right, and gave me an excellent segue into the energy sector. And, of course, black gold has also experienced a revival from sub-$30 crude oil and continues to show some signs of life. Are you looking for higher highs in 2016 for oil?
We had so much oil sloshing around for so long at those ridiculously low prices. I mean, we got down to, you know, ridiculous levels that oil is still sloshing around. It's going to take us a while. Now, could we go higher? Sure. But a sustained price at that level, I don't think we're ready yet. It's just not, the market's not ready yet. There's still too much supply. As we wean down that supply, and if we can get more cuts in production, or, you know, OPEC and wherever else, you know, you'll start to see those prices stair-step higher. Unless there's a world event that could really drive prices higher, which I don't foresee. I think we stay in this kind of 40 to 60, 65 level for quite some time. But, again, it just depends on how much and how quickly that supply is whittled away, that's on hand supply, and then how much production is being made, you know, from all over the world. It's going to really depend on those factors.
Any topics that you'd like to leave with the listeners today?
Well, again, you know, I just want to always, and I always do, I, for myself personally, for our clients, for our fund, is stress diversity. You know, I think silver and gold right now are a very good flight to quality. People, I especially like silver, and the XAU is a great way to play that, as you pointed out. To have that safe haven as a large part of your portfolio right now, I think is smart because there is so much uncertainty right now. The dollar, after all, is a fiat currency, and we know what can happen with those. Anything's possible. But I believe that precious metals will hold their value or even rise quite significantly. Either way, it's a safe haven in my book right now. Anyway, I've loved talking to you over the years. And, you know, we do advisory. You know that we write newsletters. We help retail investors in the commodity sectors, actually all of them, metals, energy, agriculture, soft commodities. We've done it all. I've been in the business around 30 years. And I've been lucky enough to work with some of the best in various markets. And then we do manage a private fund. We trade for ourselves, some of us. So kind of do it all. See what happens. We'll all be looking closely in November and see what happens next. But leading up to that, you want a secure safe haven.
I like it. I like that thinking. And I think you're right. That's the big wild card, as you say. We're going to look forward to having you back on Goldseek.
Thanks, Chris.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the 8th largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Welcome back to GoldSeek Radio.
Thank you very much.
Finally, after nearly a decade of holding rates at impossibly low levels, the Fed raised rates. Nevertheless, their counterparts in Europe and in other parts of the world are actually considering going further into negative territory. Do you see this as dollar supportive, and just what might it mean for the global currency world?
Well, I'm aware that just about anyone under the sun is so optimistic about the U.S. dollar. This is a view I do not necessarily share, because I do not expect the Fed to continue increasing rates. On the contrary, I think that sometimes in 2016, the Fed will again cut rates and more likely than not launch QE4.
QE4, I assume that would mean we'd be looking at further monetary easing plans, and we would see the purchase of mortgage-backed securities, credit default swaps, other derivatives, as well as treasuries to hold the market in place. There simply aren't enough buyers worldwide for the U.S. Treasury and for our toxic mortgage debt.
I think the economy is not very responsive any longer. And that applies to all countries in the world, to expansionary monetary policies, because they've been practiced for so long. So the impact is now diminishing. And there are many factors, aside from monetary policies and fiscal policies, that have an impact on the economy. And my sense is that the way the stock market has behaved, where the average stock is down more than 20%, but the indices are still holding up because of just a few stocks, that this is actually quite reflective of the U.S. economy, where a few companies and a few sectors are still doing okay, but the majority of sectors and the majority of people, the median household, the workers, the middle class, isn't doing well at all. So my view would be it's more likely that the U.S. will go into recession within the next 3 months, if we are not yet in a recession, because industrial production is already down. Exports are down. Imports are down. These are quite powerful indicators. Of course, then the government publishes figures about employment, but these are vastly distorted figures because if you have one job, you are fired, and then you take two part-time jobs, then statistically one job has been lost, but two have been created. So a lot of statistics are very questionable in the U.S.
You know, underemployment is certainly a big problem, as well as record levels of poverty, or at least near poverty, with approximately 50 million Americans accepting food stamps to help keep dinner on the table. We also have other leading indicators, economic indicators, that are flashing at least yellow. Manufacturing rollover heavily in the United States, which tends to precede recession.
Yes, the signs are all there that unlike all the strategists and economists who a year predicted a strengthening U.S. economy and a healing of the global economy, we have actually in most emerging markets already a recession or no growth or a very severe growth slowdown, with some sectors being in recession. All the economies in the world that depend on resources are basically in a recession. And in the U.S., and I wrote about this already 4 years ago, we have nowadays an economy and a social system that has a lot of resemblances to a banana republic.
We also have a bifurcated economy, I think you alluded to earlier. On the one hand, we see the Dallas Fed Manufacturing Index plunging to lows not seen in years, another leading indicator. But then on the other, we see the retail sector holding up surprisingly well. Strength in retail, could that be correlated to perhaps higher debt levels, giving us the illusion of strength in that sector?
Well, I mean, we have to analyze how well retail is holding up. Because if I look at all the retail stores in the U.S., the performance of their stocks has been horrible. Horrible, not just bad, but horrible. And now someone can come and say, well, this is due that people buy now online, and so the traditional retailers are all suffering and so forth. I don't buy this argument entirely. What has been strong in retailing and in consumption has been, for instance, auto sales. And auto sales have been driven largely by credit. We have now a car loan industry that is over $1 trillion, car loans. And what has also been strong are home improvement items. In other words, the Home Depots have done well. But this has also a lot to do with the fact that people don't buy homes anymore, but they improve their existing homes. Or parents, they need some new furniture for their siblings who will stay at home, can't afford an apartment anymore. So this is also a debatable statistic whether that is so healthy.
We also have had difficulty in the energy sector. West Texas Intermediate crude plunging into low 30s, perhaps on its way to the 20s. That is good for the consumer, the largest component of our domestic economy. But then, of course, you also have the difficulties that stem from the large number of energy sectors in the S&P 500 weighing heavily on that sector, and, of course, jobs as well. Any comments on the energy sector?
Well, I mean, this country with the largest industrial sector as a percent of GDP is South Korea. But the problem is that South Korea doesn't benefit much from falling commodity prices because their exports to commodity producers, including the Middle East, are larger than their exports to the EU and the U.S. combined. So when the customers have less money, they also buy less from South Korea. And so net, the benefit actually is very, very minor or even negative. In the case of South Korea, December exports were down 13%. In the U.S., the consumer would be a prime beneficiary from low energy prices. Unfortunately, the U.S. has a president that found it necessary that for most people, insurance premiums are rising by 20, 30, 40% per annum at the present time. And, you know, for people who have a lot of money, say you make $1 million a year, it doesn't matter whether your health insurance premium goes up by 30%. But if you're a family of four and middle class or working family, it makes a big difference. And if you have a car, yes, you benefit from lower oil prices, but if at the same time the tunnel fees, the toll roads, and the tolls at bridges all go up by double digits, it doesn't help you very much. So all these things have been offset to a large extent by extremely poor policies by the U.S. government.
The precious metals, a lot of aficionados in the audience here today. Higher rates ahead doesn't seem to bode too well for the metal, at least in the United States. But then with your forecast of perhaps Fed officials and policymakers having to backpedal, that might be the panacea that the precious metals bulls need.
Well, first of all, we had already a bear market in gold of more than 40% since September 2001. In other words, the bear market is more than 4 years old. Gold, compared to other assets, to stocks, bonds, and most currencies, in my view, is not particularly expensive. And the gold shares have started to outperform other stocks. And so I'm actually quite optimistic for gold to perform better than the S&P and better than other indices in 2016. In fact, I think that sentiment has been so negative recently about gold and gold shares that there is a significant upside potential. That would be my view. I'm not sure it's good news. But good news, basically, for someone who wants to buy gold would be for the gold price first to decline and provide a great buying opportunity, you understand? But I think already here it's at a very attractive level. So I bought some additional gold. Of course, I always buy gold, but on this weakness in the last month, I increased my position.
With the shocking increase in yields, it certainly doesn't seem to bode well for the debt and bond sector. Of course, stocks under pressure worldwide with Chinese policymakers and officials putting the brakes, their Shanghai index at least last week. You're obviously becoming a little more sanguine regarding the yellow metal. Do you see other interesting opportunities ahead in the commodities sector?
Yes. I mean, the same analyst who a year ago or 2 years ago were predicting oil to go to $150. Now they say it will go to 20. I don't know whether it will go to 20 or not, but my sense is that between this level and 20, the market is very inexpensive. And my view would be that we could have a sharp rebound. Maybe not. I mean, maybe, most likely not to new highs, but say to an equilibrium price of between, say, $40 and $60, maybe $70. So, yes, I think in the commodities complex, there are now opportunities. I have to say that for individuals, to play the commodity markets is not that simple. First of all, they need a futures account. And many people in the U.S., they don't want to have a futures account or they don't know how to open one. Then they buy ETFs, commodity ETFs. Commodity ETFs are just about the worst investment anyone can ever make because the rollover cost is far too high. So if a commodity, if you buy a commodity ETF and the commodity doesn't go up 30% in a year, you will probably lose money. Physical gold the storage cost is relatively low, and you can buy physical gold, and you don't have to roll it over. So I would buy, if you really believe in a commodities rebound, my belief would be that precious metals would actually outperform other commodities.
And it also has the added benefits of avoiding rehypothecation and related issues that have come up all over the world, not to mention potential confiscation issues, margin-related problems, and just a time where regulations and policies are coming into place that I think the typical investor may not be prepared for. The middle class used to be the backbone, if you will, of societies in the Western world, and it really was the aspiration of the working classes that their progeny might reach the goal of the middle class. That was really the dream that drove, I think, so much of the economic, and still does today to some extent. But we've just seen at least erosion of the middle class in the United States, maybe not so much in China and other BRIC nations. Can you give tips to the American middle class listeners today to help improve their economic situation?
Well, when I look back at the 50s and 60s and how rich Americans were relative to the rest of the world, I'm talking here relative, American workers, they earned a lot of money. They could go to Europe on holidays and live in Europe far above the life standard of Europeans, because the dollar at the time was very strong. It bought over 4 Deutschmark and 4 Swiss francs, whereas now it buys exactly about 1 Swiss franc. So a lot of things have changed in the world. We have, in the Western world, not just in the U.S., a generation of people that will die poorer and earn less in real terms, inflation-adjusted, than their parents in the 50s and 60s, whereas in emerging economies, I can say that in China, we didn't have a middle class 30 years ago. And if I measure, say, a middle class, a simple indicator would be how many people can go on holidays, and how many people can buy a car and so forth. So in China, for instance, in the mid-80s, there were less than 5 million Chinese traveling overseas. They were not allowed. And then by year 2000, there were 10 million Chinese traveling overseas, and now there are 120 million Chinese traveling overseas every year. With a shift in the balance of economic power, and it is, say, sad for me to see that the Western world has lost, relatively speaking, so much in such a brief period of time. And the only explanation I have for this loss in relative prosperity in such a short period of time are, and I can't use the word I would like to use, the government's idiotic policies and their interventions into free markets and with monetary policies that then lead to essentially an enrichment of few people, very few people, not 1%, 0.01%, and essentially an impoverishment of the majority of people. The media, they have been bought by the government, or their owners are bought by the government. They will always paint a nice picture of what is happening in the economy, because they just watch the stock market and they watch Wall Street and New York, that lives essentially from tourists, and the money printing that flows first into the financial sector. So, of course, there is the trickle-down effect in New York. It hasn't really reached Main Street.
Perhaps you'd like to share with us a brief overview of your perspective on the year 2016, this new year.
Well, I think I mentioned before in interviews, I don't think the stock market will go up and that it will close lower. and that we will drop between 20 and 40% from the May 2015 high, S&P 2,134. However, I'm not the clairvoyant about what the Fed will do and other central banks. I think, as I mentioned in just now, that the Fed will embark on QE4, but to really have an impact and push markets to new highs, they will have to do a massive QE4. I would imagine in the order of $150 billion asset purchase every month. And whether politically that will be acceptable is debatable because the elections are coming up.
Well, thanks again, Dr. Faber, for another excellent economic overview. We wish you an excellent 2016.
Thank you very much.